There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We are here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we do so as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. They certainly don't need another opinion piece. But they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? Well, I invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary we don't have time to share here on the air. You could also like The Reconnect on Facebook and let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, let's lead off today with the continuing concern and issue over America's drug problem. Now, ultimately, America's drug problem is a spiritual problem. But the question today before us is, does the opioid epidemic justify a national state of emergency? That is what has been proposed by the White House's commission to battle the opioid crisis. They are urging President Trump to declare a federal state of emergency to address the epidemic. So here is the information posted, in this case, from The Atlantic, but you can actually pick up this information at a lot of sources. Trump's opioid commission calls for a state of emergency and for giving every police officer naloxone. We've also talked about that same drug by a different name. And these are the drugs that actually reverse overdoses that are opioid induced. Okay, so the Government Opioid Commission is chaired by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. And that commission has called upon President Trump to declare a state of emergency as the opioid epidemic now kills more than 100 Americans every day. Did you think about that? More than 100 Americans died yesterday of opioid overdoses, and another 100 will die today and another 100 tomorrow. This is an epidemic. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, has actually been calling this an epidemic since 2011. And some states have also declared states of emergency in relationship to the opioid epidemic. Florida is one of those states. May 4th of 2017, Florida Governor Rick Scott declared a state of health emergency in the state of Florida related to this. So that declaration allows the state of Florida to tap into more than $54 million in U.S. Department of Human Health and Services grant money that pays for prevention, treatment, and recovery services. Governor Scott also gave the green light to the state's Surgeon General to start distributing the anti-overdose treatment naloxone to first responders. This is what Governor Scott said at the time. "I know firsthand how heartbreaking substance abuse can be to a family because it impacted my own family growing up. The individuals struggling with drug use are sons, daughters, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, and friends. And each tragic case leaves loved ones searching for answers and praying for help." In his press release, the governor also said, this is back in May, that he was making his announcement following the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention declaring a national opioid epidemic back in 2011. Well, so that happened in 2011. The governor of Florida declared that state to be officially in an opioid epidemic in May. And now we have this national commission, federal opioid commission, asking the president to declare a state of emergency across the country. Such a declaration, which several states, including Florida, have already made, would empower the cabinet to take steps, including encouraging Congress to focus on funding and empowering the executive branch to deal further with the incredible loss of life related to this particular epidemic. The report recommended a number of reforms to opioid treatment and overdose prevention, many of which would make it easier for addicts to get treatment. They recommend changes to law enforcement, such as arming all police officers with naloxone, a medication that reverses opioid overdoses and improves the detection of fentanyl at the border. So there you go. We have talked here on the Reconnect before about the opioid crisis here in America. We have talked about the questions surrounding it for families, and we have talked about the questions surrounding it for law enforcement as well. This is an issue of crisis proportions across the country. You and your family may be touched by it as well. I know that in my own family, you know, my husband's best friend, his son died of an unintentional opioid overdose just last year. This last week, officials at the Red Lake Indian Reservation in Minnesota, which is home to the Chippewa, declared a public health emergency as the tribe's opioid epidemic continues to worsen. Tribal leaders there say that overdoses are on the rise related to heroin, increasingly laced with fentanyl. And again, that fentanyl is something that has become a particularly dangerous part of this conversation. Right now, I mean, literally right now, the president's nominee to take over the post of Surgeon General is in a nomination hearing before the Senate Health Committee. Dr. Jerome Adams previously served as the head of Indiana's health department during Vice President Mike Pence's tenure as Indiana's governor. And Dr. Adams is trained as an anesthesiologist, and he has advocated for the importance of addressing the opioid epidemic. So we may very well be getting a Surgeon General who actually knows something about this particular issue and hopefully will lead us and our nation toward health, mental health, and in terms of substance abuse issues. Also on the docket today in Washington is the nomination of Dr. Eleanor McCants-Katz. That is President Trump's pick to run the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is the federal government's agency with a $3.6 billion a year budget that goes toward grants helping states pay for mental health and addiction treatment. So there's a lot happening today on this front, which is why I wanted to surface it. I want to remind you that I guess it was back at May the 22nd that we actually talked about opioid addiction. We talked about redemption from it. And we talked with Victor Torres. You will remember that he has a ministry that is specifically related to this issue. And he is a person who comes out of drug addiction and even the drug culture. And so if you want to go and grab that particular podcast from the Reconnect, you do it at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You're going to look for the May 22nd edition of the show and listen to our conversation with Victor Torres about addiction, redemption, and the current opioid crisis. So the truth is, unless and until we deal with the underlying depression, mental illness, sense of meaninglessness that people experience, we are not going to be able to address drug addiction, opioids included, simply with answers like arming our police officers with drugs that serve as a counter agent. We're going to have to, at some point, get to the place as a culture where we're speaking a hope-filled truth into the lives of other people. Whereas Christians, we actually are taking the gospel out into a world that is filled with desperation, where people have no sense of meaning and purpose or belonging, and therefore they are choosing to fill that void in their life with something that will cause them even momentary, I'll use the word joy, although you and I both know that's not really what it is, at least a momentary ecstatic experience. People are genuinely yearning to know that they matter. They need to know who they are. They need to know that they're a child of God. They need to know that they are an image bearer. They need to know that they can inherit the kingdom of heaven regardless of what their life is like here on the earth. They need to know that they could be a part of a family, even if their own family is frankly not worth the title. They could be a part of the household of God. Like, we got to step up, people. It is time to be speaking the word of the hope of the gospel into, not just into the culture, but actually specifically into the lives of desperate individuals. The gospel answers the questions of, do I matter? Do I belong? Does my life have a purpose? The gospel answers all of those questions, both in temporal and eternal ways. And that's the challenge that each and every one of us has when we recognize that the opioid epidemic actually now touches everyone. It is not a respecter of age or color or anything else that tends to be a dividing wall of hostility between us and our culture. The opioid epidemic knows none of those barriers. It is not a respecter of persons. And so you and I, we got to be taking the gospel out there into the world. We ultimately know that that's the answer to this question, to this desperation that people are experiencing. So let me just encourage you to be equipped with the gospel and be unashamedly evangelical out there in the world. People want to know they matter. They want to know that they belong, and they want to know their life has a purpose. And you have a story of redemption that you can share with them. And then you have the redemption guy. His name is Jesus. And you can share his story as the answer to the desperation they are currently facing. And then, absolutely, you got to invite them into the community of God's people, where they're going to find some fellowship, where they actually are going to find some belonging, and where they can get real tangible help in this temporal life. All right, friends, this desperation conversation reminded me of another conversation that we had back in April. We talked then about the Netflix original series 13 Reasons. Do you remember that, 13 Reasons Why? 13 Reasons Why is a Netflix original series that is, I'm going to use the word glamorizes suicide. And in my view, promotes self-harm. We talked about it here on the show. We actually produced a resource in response related to this. You can get all of that at reconnectwithcarmen.com. The reason I bring it up today is it's only taken just a few months for the Journal of American, it's internal medicine. So it's JAMA, but it's particularly the internal medicine edition of JAMA. So you're going to want to check this out. JAMA has published a report that actually shows, I mean, this is now, you know, research showing that Google searches related to suicide and suicidal ideation increased almost 20% in the 19 days after the release of 13 Reasons Why. Now, there's a reason that there's a narrow window of time that they did this research. They did this research between the time that the Netflix series was released and the day Aaron Hernandez committed suicide, because on the day he committed suicide, you would expect Google searches for the term suicide to spike. So they didn't want their research influenced by that particular very dramatic event in our culture. And so between the show's premiere on March 31st and April the 18th, the day before the suicide of football player Aaron Hernandez, is when this particular research group did this study. So the results are pretty striking. During the weeks after the show's release, suicide-related queries jumped by 19%, reflecting 900,000 to 1.5 million more searches than expected. Searches for the phrases, how to commit suicide, how to kill yourself, were all higher during this window of time. Searches for the terms suicide hotline number, suicide hotline, and suicide prevention were also up. So the JAMA report suggested that 13 Reasons Why did not do enough to reduce the connection between the show and suicidal ideation, which means actually thinking about committing suicide and imagining how you might do it. So the JAMA report cites the World Health Organization's media guidelines for preventing suicide, and they discuss ways that the makers of the show could have either removed scenes that are very dramatically depicting suicide, or addressing the issue by indicating the suicide hotline number in every episode. I mean, that is something that would have been simple for them to do. Tragically, that didn't happen, and an increase in suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation. We talked about the response of school districts that said suicidal ideation was up even among junior hires. And you say to yourself, well, how is that possible? Because after all, Netflix attaches the TV MA rating to these episodes. That's TV mature. And they also indicate in episodes containing what they describe as more explicit material, which I will tell you every episode has explicit material. But anyway, they pick out a few episodes where sexual assault, bullying, and suicide are actually depicted. And they put on those particular episodes a warning at the beginning of the show. So what Netflix is saying is, because we put the warning at the beginning of the show and because the entire series is rated TV MA, You know, nobody who's not a mature adult should be watching this. Well, first of all, that's ridiculous. It features teenagers. It's designed for teenagers. It's marketed to teenagers. So there's no question that teenagers, who, by the way, are not mature adults. I mean, they're not even adults, let alone mature. There's no way that Netflix can actually deny that that's who they designed this for and who they're marketing it to. So it's disingenuous for Netflix to say, hey, you know, we're within the guidelines. In fact, Netflix responded to the JAMA study in an inquiry from USA Today saying this: "We always believed the show would increase discussion around this tough subject matter. And this is an interesting quasi-experimental study that confirms this. We are looking forward to more research and taking everything we learned to heart as we prepare for season two." So they are not backing down. It's not as if they're going to pull season one. In fact, they are working on, my friends, season two. Suicide, by the way, is the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds in the United States. Nearly 5,000 people, 10 to 24 every year, kill themselves in America. And so this is an issue. It is of concern. And if you're saying to yourself, I don't even know if my kids have seen it or are watching it, here's the reality. If they have friends who have seen it and are watching it, then your kids have seen it and are watching it. It's not just about whether or not your kids have unlimited access to Netflix. It's whether any of their friends do. It's whether any of the, you know, overnights that they've had over the summer, any place that they have been for any length of time with any other teenagers, this is a part of what is happening now among teenagers in America. In fact, the show has actually already been seen, viewed by enough people to confer upon it cult classic status. Now, when that happens, even more young people find ways to watch it. And so we certainly want to advise parents that if your teenagers are watching or have watched this series, then you have to. And you need to be engaging them in actual conversation between episodes. One of the most dangerous parts of this is that they're binge watching it, which means they're not even taking time in between to digest what happened in the last episode or even talk through it with anyone. They are simply moving on to the next layer of this, you know, frankly, most destructive of shows. Okay, let me highlight for you really quickly a conversation that we're going to have here tomorrow on The Reconnect. So tomorrow afternoon on The Reconnect, we are going to be talking with Andrew Walker about a new book that he's got coming out about God and the transgender revolution. So it is a book about what the Bible actually says about this sexual identity crisis that we've got going on in America. Let me go ahead and tease that for you today, let you know that that's happening tomorrow, because I'm going to lift up two really disturbing things. I may only have time to lift up one disturbing thing, but anyway, at least one really disturbing headline related to transgenderism in the United States. This is a story that we have been covering all summer, and now I can report to you that Tristan Rees — you will remember that Tristan Rees is the woman who understands herself to be a man. She has, in her understanding of herself, transitioned from female to male and was pregnant at the time that we first highlighted this story. This is a person who lives in Portland, Oregon. And this is now how CNN reports the latest development in the story. CNN says — now, I want you to listen to the words they choose to use and the delusion, the culture-wide delusion that CNN is participating in. Culture-wide delusion here. Here we go. Tristan Rees, a transgender man — which, by the way, is something that doesn't exist — living in Portland, Oregon, has given birth to a boy. Now, first of all, there's no way a man gives birth to a boy. With his partner of 7 years, Biff Chaplow, their son — note these words — their son, Leo Marie Chaplow, was born July 14th. Leo is the couple's first biological child. Now, if we have a biological child, then we have a biological woman and we have a biological man. So it's nonsense. It is nonsense. It is absolute confusion, and it is cultural delusion to be referring to these two individuals as men. If this is a biological baby, which they say it is, and one of the people in this biological union carried a baby to term, conceived a baby and carried a baby to term, that person is a woman. That person is gender dysphoric, no question about it. This person perceives themselves to be a man, but that's gender dysphoria. That is gender dysphoria. This is still a woman. She gave birth to a baby that she conceived in a relationship with a man. Okay, I know. You think I become exasperated by these things, and really, I'm just trying to encourage us to read the headlines of the day with the mind of Christ. This article on CNN goes on to say, Reese, who was assigned the female gender at birth. Okay, no, that's not true. This is a female person. This female person just had a baby. All right. This Reese, who was assigned the female gender at birth, posted a video in March explaining his decision to carry a baby as a transgender man. Quote, I'm okay with my body being a trans body. I'm okay being a man who has a uterus and has the capacity and capability of carrying a baby. No, my friend, you are a woman. The fact that you have a uterus and can carry a baby is an indication of that. It's confirmation of that. It's the way the truth is borne out in reality. Now, I want to be gentle in response, and I want for us to be compassionate, but I don't want us to get sucked into the delusion. And so that's one of the reasons we're going to have a conversation tomorrow with Andrew Walker. He is going to help us understand how we can disagree with transgenderism without denying the very real pain of gender dysphoria, which these people around us are experiencing. He's also going to help us understand what the Bible says. And the Bible confirms that, you know, a man can't become a woman and a woman can't become a man. Male and female are actually distinct, different ways of being made in the image of God. And God does so intentionally at creation. He's also going to talk with us about how the Bible supplies the framework for understanding what we are experiencing in our culture in the midst of the transgender revolution. So don't miss tomorrow's show where we're going to get to talk to Andrew Walker. All right. Hey, before we go to the break, I want to lift up three quick international hotspots. I'm going to call this the Praying the News segment. I just made that up. So this is the Praying the News segment of the show today. And today we are going to pray for Venezuela, North Korea, and Russia. We're not actually praying for the countries. We're really praying for the people of these countries. So in Venezuela, there is, frankly, an all-out revolution underway. Socialism on the verge of civil war. People there are facing starvation in a country with the world's largest oil reserves. So it's a resource-rich country with an absolute dictator at the head who is allowing his own people to starve to death. So we want to be praying for the people of Venezuela and also praying for Colombia, because Colombia is in receipt of a massive, massive refugee flow out of Venezuela as people seek to escape death. We also want to lift up the people of North Korea. None of us can imagine, now that we find ourselves in the crosshairs of a nuclear ready North Korea with intercontinental ballistic missiles that we now learn may be able to reach all the way to the east coast of the continental United States. If you are the least bit afraid of North Korea and what they might do, imagine that you lived there. Imagine the kind of fear and terror that people living in North Korea live with every day. So let's be praying for the people who live in bondage in that country. And let's pray for the people of Russia and our relationship with that nation. We have entered what the media is describing as a new Cold War. All right, friends, The Reconnect is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. So go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and give us a little support. We'd really appreciate it. Become a reconnector. Support the ministry with prayer and financial support so we can expand the reach of what we do. reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. You are not alone. Hey, we're here to put God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, the hills and valleys of life. We are seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter, at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, back with me today for our regular visit, regular checkup. I'm beginning to feel, George, as if this is like a regular checkup with a friend. So with us today is George Barna. He is the executive director of the American Culture and Faith Institute. You will recognize him as the person who founded the Barna Research Group, and he's been president of Metaformation, a faith development organization, since 2009. He is a extremely well-known pollster. He is a New York Times best-selling author. He's written more than 50 books. Most of them address cultural trends, leadership, spiritual development, and church dynamics. You can check it all out and check out what we're talking about today at culturefaith.com. And you can follow George on Twitter at George_Barna. George, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Carmen, it's always great to be with you.
Oh, it's always great to hear your voice and to read about what you're doing. So I was reading this, Faith Minimally Affects Death Penalty Views. You just posted this particular very interesting research at the culturefaith.com website. So I want you to bring us up to speed on this fascinating topic of research. What did you find about the relationship between faith and belief in the death penalty?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those issues that we're finding out of this research people don't really give much time to think about. It's an issue where Americans support the death penalty by a 3-to-1 margin, but then when you dig deeper to try to understand, well, why do you support it? Or if you don't, why don't you support it? What you find is they really haven't reflected very much about the implications of taking another person's life. I mean, the United States has been using the death penalty in various forms and, you know, doing these executions in various ways for more than 300 years. And as best we can tell, on a state-by-state basis, there have been more than 16,000 lives taken through the death penalty. And yet when we ask people why they believe what they believe, they're not sure. And then when we look at, well, how does your faith inform the position that you've taken, that's where it gets kind of discouraging to me, is that people have not yet created a habit of trying to go back to the scriptures, trying to go back and reflect on the life of Christ, trying to figure out what does it mean to be a devoted follower of Christ, and given that kind of mindset, or what we would call a worldview, how then should I think about an issue like this? And so essentially what we found is that people were more likely to tell us that they don't know what the Bible has to say about the death penalty or which direction it would even push us in, than they are to say that they either support or reject the death penalty. So to me, it's one of those issues where, again, the big picture implication is we've got to learn how to think biblically, because otherwise we just make decisions based on how we feel at that moment and the last best argument that we might have heard from somebody about that particular issue.
All right, friends, we're talking with George Barna about the findings of a study seeking to understand where Americans are at on support of the death penalty. And they did find, you know, pretty significant consensus, 3-to-1 margin, Americans support the use of the death penalty or the application of it in certain cases. But when you get down into how does my faith affect that and how does my faith influence that, and in particular, you know, how does my view of what the Bible says about these things affect it, it just, the numbers just get, it's sad. I mean, it's, you said it in a much more articulate way than I did, but I'm just going to use the word sad. It's sad to think that Christians in America have not thought about how they think about the taking of another human life and thought about it from a biblical perspective, particularly because Jesus Christ is somebody who, you know, died because of the death penalty.
Yeah, and that's the irony of it all, you know. So you look at this, and when we asked whether or not they think the Bible would approve of us using the death penalty, the biggest answer we got was people saying, I don't know. I don't know what the Bible has to say about it. Almost 4 out of 10 Americans took that position, as opposed to 34% who said they think the Bible probably would support it, 28% who said they didn't think the Bible would support it. And then when you look at their perceptions of, well, what would Jesus say about the death penalty? We asked them whether or not he would approve it. And again, we found that a third of all Americans, one out of every three, said, I don't know what Jesus would say about that. And then you've got, you know, 41% who said they think he would be against it, and 27% who say he'd approve it. But like I say, so the big takeaway for me is we don't know. Even among the, you know, born-again Christians, among regular churchgoers, every one of the faith segments that we normally look at, huge proportions of them said, I don't know. And my admonition, my exhortation, particularly to the scriptural teachers, to pastors, seminary professors, Bible college teachers, all these people, would be, you know what, the greatest gift you could give us is not filling up the room. It would be filling up our minds and our hearts with an understanding of the core principles that help us to think about how should I live my life? What should I support in life? What should I oppose in life? How do I back those choices up scripturally? And it's not just the death penalty. This is part of a bigger study that I'm currently doing on, does America have a culture of life? Do we want to support the idea that life is sacred? And so we have a companion study that we've done on abortion. We have another companion study that we've just done on war. You know, and we're putting all of these things together, trying to figure out, are we thinking carefully about and biblically about the whole idea of life? But I think what we're finding from all of these studies, and we'll be releasing that information in coming weeks, but what we're finding generally is that people don't make their decisions based on what the Bible teaches us. Whether we look at the environment, whether we look at immigration, whether we look at bioethics, whether we look at taxation, I mean, all of these issues that we're studying, when we ask these kinds of questions about what are the biblical principles that inform your thinking about what side to be on, people say, I don't even know if the Bible has principles on these things. And so,
well, let's walk down that path for a moment, George, because I know you're somebody who has given thought to that. So if you were going to then, in the midst of a conversation with a person who admitted, I don't actually know. I don't actually know if the Bible has any principles related to this. Do you have one sort of go-to, life is sacred text or principle that you lift up?
Well, what I try to do with people is I say, okay, well, let's think about what the concepts are that are involved in this process and what the Bible says about those. Let's think about some of the biblical narratives that might relate to this. Because I don't want to tell you what to believe, because then you won't hold on to it. You won't own it.
Right.
And I want you to own your position. So let me just ask you some questions. You know, and then I'll talk to them about, okay, well, does the Ten Commandments have anything to do with life or death? You know, we'll come to thou shalt not murder. Okay, that's good. That's a start. So we know the Bible has something to say about the importance of life. What about some other biblical expressions that you've heard? Eye for an eye. Okay. All right. Well, that may be relevant to this, too. But, you know, what do you think the whole purpose of life is? You know, and we'll talk about that. And, you know, ultimately it's to love. Okay, well, is it loving to murder a person if they've killed somebody else? Well, you have to think about that, you know, because on the other side of that scale might be the whole concept of justice. What does the Bible teach us about justice? Okay, well, that's part of it. But then we've got to talk about the whole notion of forgiveness. You know, do we have a bigger obligation to fulfill the eye for an eye kind of justice, or a bigger obligation to fulfill the notion that God forgives people, I need to forgive people, maybe it's not my right to take somebody else's life if God has forgiven them, you know, but then we have to ask about, well, did they ask for forgiveness, or was there a sense of remorse? You know, a lot of things that come in there, and then, you know, we come to the whole area about, well, we know that someday you're going to have to answer for what you've done in this life. Is God using you to make people answer for their behavior? Does he ever do that? Would he do that in this situation? You know, and then you've got the, as you suggest, you know, there are passages that talk about the fact that life is God's sacred gift to us. Do we have a responsibility, or do we even have a right to take that gift away from somebody, or is that God's alone to take away? So these are the kinds of questions that I think we as believers need to wrestle with. I can't tell somebody what to believe. Often I can't even, you know, tell them what I think their worldview should say, but I can tell you that their worldview needs to be based on the scriptures. And for whatever position they come out on, even if I disagree with it, you know, I feel pretty good about it if they're going to argue it from the basis of biblical text, as opposed to arguing it from the basis of the government law is this and society feels that and my emotions lead me to believe this. No, you tell me what you think the scriptural principles would be and how that fits into your overarching life narrative. It's got to fit within the framework of how you understand life to work, how you understand God calling you to live in light of those principles. That's what a biblical worldview does. It gives you those tracks to run on. And if you can't think about an issue like the death penalty using that kind of a worldview, kind of that mental and spiritual grid that gives you the right way to travel, then you haven't done your homework yet. You better get busy.
Well, and I think, George, one of the concerns that I have is, frankly, how pragmatic our culture has become in relationship to many of these conversations. So we now take a very pragmatic approach, or many people do, to the idea of conception and whether or not a child conceived is going to be allowed to be brought to term, right? I mean, you know, you can't really have the conversation about whether or not I have the right to take another person's life in a culture where, you know, we're slaughtering the unborn. And so it's, I think part of the challenge here is that when you begin down the path of, am I going to allow my life to be guided by, actually lived in submission to the God who reveals himself in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments? I'm actually going to seek to have my life be conformed to the image of Christ, to what God wants, to bringing God glory and honor in everything all the time. If that's actually what I'm going to do, then the conversations that we're having as a culture related to the preborn has got to change. And certainly the conversations related to end-of-life issues would be heavily influenced. These right-to-die conversations that we're having in the culture today are completely pragmatic. They're increasingly about whether or not the person feels like their life is complete or full, or they feel like they're in too significant an amount of pain or mental distress to continue living. Whether disregarding altogether, you know, that God has numbered our days and that God is the one who holds life and death in his hands and all eternity and knows us before we're born, from before the very foundations of the earth and into eternity. So I think that when you talk about a biblical worldview and what's lacking in people's understanding of the engagement with these issues, they don't know God.
Those are great points, you know, and then, yeah, I mean, part of that knowing God is understanding his character, you know, and realizing that he is the ultimate judge. I'm not. In American society, we have the tension of wanting to have control over every aspect of our life. And so, as you suggest, many times we make pragmatic decisions because they make us happy, they make us comfortable, they make us secure. They fulfill our felt needs at the moment. But felt needs change over the course of time. And when we're talking about taking somebody's life, if my need is different today than it is 10 years from now, and therefore my position on taking somebody's life may be different because my emotions and my needs and my life situation has changed, that's a tough one to defend when you then go back and look at, but wait a minute, if God is the judge, on what basis does he judge? What basis do I have for making those same judgments and then carrying them out? We can't operate based on cultural default mechanisms. And that's so often what we wind up doing.
All right, I always love talking to you. Friends, his name is George Barna. You can check out what we're talking about at culturefaith.com. This particular part of this life study is Faith Minimally Affects Death Penalty Views. This was just posted on July the 26th. Let me tease out one paragraph as we let George go. And again, George, thank you again for joining us on the Reconnect. Listen to this, folks. This new national study conducted by the American Culture and Faith Institute reveals that American adults support the use of the death penalty by a 3-to-1 margin. The most substantial support comes from Republicans, people from households making more than $100,000 annually, conservatives, people 65 and older, and men. The most widespread opposition comes from blacks, liberals, millennials, and Democrats. Friends, this is a place where Christians need to be leading the cultural conversation. There ought to be Christians who are engaged with a biblical worldview leading this conversation in the culture, because obviously, as Americans, we're just all over the map. Hey, George Barna, thanks again for joining us on the Reconnect. We love having you.
Thank you so much.
All right, friends, I'm betting that piqued your interest and curiosity. Check it all out at culturefaith.com. It's time in the show to go below the fold, lift up a story and make a connection that's designed to help you start or engage with other people in conversations that don't initially appear to be about God, but where you can introduce eternal principles, biblical principles, that would lead the conversation or direct the conversation in a way that, well, God might come up. And that person might begin thinking differently about what they're thinking about. So that's exactly what George Barna and I were just talking about. And here I'm going to bring an application to bear on, I don't know, there probably should be some Olympic music right now, but I forgot to ask for it. So if someone could hum the, no, in your mind right now, hum that Olympic music. Isn't there like an Olympic music? Yeah, anyway, okay. So if there were Olympic music, it would be playing right now to the announcement that Los Angeles is going to host the 2028 Olympic Games. That's so exciting. That is so exciting. I went to the Summer Olympics when they were held in Atlanta. It is thrilling. It's absolutely thrilling to get to attend the Olympic Games. And if you've ever had the opportunity, you know what I'm talking about. It is, this is going to mean that there's going to be a torch relay all the way across America, and lots of people are going to get to line the streets, and every community is going to get to pick a person to represent them, and as they run the torch, and there'll be the torch relay, and there'll be all kinds of great stuff. And you say to yourself, what has this to do with God? Well, let me ask this. What's the first Olympic Games that you remember? My first one that I like remember watching was 1976, the Montreal Games, and the star of the whole show was Nadia Comaneci. All right? She was so little. I don't know if you remember this. So this is, she was 14 years old in the Montreal Games. And she gave these literally perfect performances, perfect gymnastics performances. It was stunning. It was absolutely stunning. It was awe-inspiring. Now, granted, I was 8 years old. So it's pretty easy to inspire an 8-year-old. Now, was I inspired to take up gymnastics? No, I was not. But I was inspired by the pageantry and the commitment and obviously the hard work that this very young person had invested in perfecting her craft. And then I also remember in 1996, Carrie Strug. Do you remember her? Because if you want an American hero in the Summer Olympics, here's your girl, right? 1996, Atlanta. This is just 20 years ago. Carrie Strug was 18 years old. 4 years prior to that, she had competed in the Barcelona Olympics. Here's one random fact. My sister lives across the street from Carrie Strug's parents in Tucson, Arizona. So there you go. There's a little fun fact of the day from Carmen. So Carrie started training when she was 3 years old, and she set her eye on the prize. And so in 1996, when in the middle of these Olympic Games, they needed a high value vault. They needed one of the girls on the American team to really excel. And Carrie injured her leg on her first vault and limped back. And her coach basically said, "Look, we need you." The girl before her had fallen twice. "We need you. We need you." And with grit and determination on a badly damaged leg, she ran and she delivered the vault of a lifetime, and she stuck the landing. And then she collapsed to the mat and had to be carried off and ultimately carried to the platform to receive her medal. It's awe-inspiring. In 2028, the Olympic Games are going to be in L.A. That's 11 years from now, which means that the people who will be competing in the L.A. 2028 Games are currently toddlers and elementary school kids. I want you to ask yourself right now, who is inspiring the toddlers? And who is inspiring the elementary age children in our country today? Who is inspiring them to dream toward that which passion and focus and dedication are going to be required in order for them to pursue with discipline to the point of perfection? Something. It doesn't have to be gymnastics. It doesn't have to be swimming. It doesn't have to be basketball or baseball or vault. I mean, all of the things that come with the Summer Olympics. But we should be inspiring our toddlers and our elementary school children to something that is great and grand and world-changing. Helping them dream toward something where they could focus their energy and imagination and attention and voluntarily dedicate their lives to the pursuit of some disciplined perfection toward one aim. It doesn't have to be a gold medal. It could be the upward calling. It could be the upward calling of the prize of Jesus Christ. So 2028 is now 11 years off. It's 11 years away. Let me ask you, toward what are you planning? And how are you intending to get there? You got some prize you're aiming for? Is it in this world or is it in the next? How hard are you training right now to actually win the prize of the upward calling to which you have been called in Christ Jesus our Lord? How disciplined is my discipleship? That is ultimately what I wrote down when I was thinking about Nadia Comaneci and when I was thinking about Carrie Strug. And I could make a list of other people like Michael Phelps, with whose performances at subsequent Summer Olympics I have been incredibly impressed. Who is that Bolt guy from Jamaica? I like him a lot. Okay, Usain Bolt. Isn't that his name? Okay, so, you know, you got to think about, like, how much training and preparation and discipline and getting up every day and committing yourself toward the upward prize. Now, for them, there's a gold medal and a stage and a time to beat and other competitors in the field. And maybe you need to feel like you have that set before you as a disciple in order that you would become disciplined in your discipleship. You do realize those come from the same word, right? The word disciple and the word discipline. Most of us, frankly, let's just admit it, have very undisciplined discipleship. We're horribly undisciplined disciples. And so let me encourage you to not just think about what you're thinking about, but to consider whether or not you're actually willing to do whatever it takes. Because these Olympians, these Olympic athletes, they will literally do whatever it takes. I think my concern is so many Christians in our culture take sort of a whatever approach to things instead of an approach that says whatever it takes. Whatever it takes to advance the gospel of Jesus Christ always and in all ways. Whatever it takes today, whatever it takes of me, it doesn't matter. For it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And this life I press toward his purpose and his purpose alone. All right, friends, that's all we got time for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, and share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.